My question is in regards to the timeline of the Anunnaki creating human beings. I hear some say 500,000 years ago. I hear some say 50,000 years ago. I see others say much more recently. Please help me see this more clearly. I'm a big fan, and I suggest your work to many people who seek answers.
Well, thanks, Bronk Lander, for recommending me. I think that when we listen to ancestral stories about the origins of humanity, we're looking at a very long timeline indeed, and very probably a number of interventions that have tweaked the progress of humanity along the way. In my studies, I've certainly found a lot of evidence from cultural story all around the world that point to an intervention just on this side of the Younger Dryas Cold period. And in my book, The Eden Enigma, that's where I'm focusing on stories that have been retained in the lands of ancient Armenia that talk about an intervention at a time when our survival as humanity really hung in the balance. And it talks about the Tingir, those who visited, those who got us through that critical period. And they are really stories of a positive kind relating to interventions in the development of humanity as we know ourselves to be. But there are other stories, certainly layered into the biblical stories, layered into the Mayan stories, layered into the Vedic stories, that would suggest that there were earlier interventions to define what Homo sapiens became. And so in some of the creation of man stories, I find patterns that would suggest interventions, yes, as long ago as you were suggesting, Bronk Lander, 500,000 years ago, that everything that led to the separation of the hominids from the primates and then humans from everybody else has been assisted, that it's not been an entirely natural process right from those early stages. And I think one place you can go for this longer perspective is the Popol Vuh, which tells the Guatemala Maya story of human origins. And it talks about how the intervention of the feathered serpents resulted, for instance, in human beings and the ape-like creatures that live in the forest, is the phrase that it uses. And so if the feathered serpent's work is resulting in apes and humans, then that pushes the story of intervention far, far deeper into history. And I think that when I read, for instance, the stories of beginnings in the Bible, there are a number of traumatic memories that seem to be retained in those stories. And they line up with traumatic memories in the Popol Vuh, and they parallel traumatic memories that we can find in the Mesopotamian stories. And they suggest interventions all through from more than 500,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, up to a point where human beings are smart enough to work in someone else's mine, but not intelligent enough to farm, and then up to this intervention I talked about post the Younger Dryas, where being taught to farm is what's on the syllabus. And this would be included in the Babylonian telling of Oannes and the Apkallu, where these non-human beings come and they teach humanity how to farm, how to do civil engineering, how to become a civilization, how to live in denser populations, how to manage a city, how to set up a money system, legal systems, and all the rest of it. All of them in one great package, according to the writings of the Greek Babylonian priest Berossus. And we can find parallels to that in ancient story around the world. And in my book, The Invasion of Eden, I point to parallels in the Hawaiian story of the Mo'o and the Ahumanu, which repeat this same sort of moment of transformation and this sort of bureaucratization of the human experience. And so, yes, there have been many interventions. I think the evidence is for an intervention about 10,000 years ago, a very strong and international, a little bit more sketchy further back, but enough clues to show that our story has been, shall we say, we've been a curated species for a very, very long time.
What is your opinion on sleep paralysis? Is there a tangible or spiritual meaning behind it? Or is it simply a physical issue with the brain and the muscles?
Hi, Richard. You'd be surprised how many people have asked me this question. I think sleep paralysis can refer to a couple of different things, or can refer to the same thing happening for different reasons. So I think sometimes it is to do with our state of consciousness and the modulation of our brain, where we're conscious enough to be aware, but somehow we're not conscious enough to move. And people experience that as sleep paralysis, and it can be very distressing. It may coincide with other brain activity that creates experiences that are perceived but not real. But I have heard from people who have had close encounter experiences, and paralysis has been something they've experienced alongside the close encounter experience. So I think there are a number of things going on. I think we can have a sleep paralysis experience and be frightened and misinterpret what we're experiencing, or just be distressed by the experience. But I think there are moments where real encounter phenomena happen, where people are perceiving other entities in their space and they can't move away. They can't get out of bed. They can't stand up. They can't walk away. And through having heard this report from many, many people who've come to me for coaching over the years, I believe it's a real phenomenon. It's not something I've experienced myself. I have had close encounter experiences, but none that have paralyzed me in that way. But I do believe that it is something that happens. I think separating the two can be helpful, because some people become anxious simply by the sleep paralysis thing because they think something else is going to happen. And at times, nothing else happens. It's just a sleep paralysis that you're experiencing. But I reckon if you're having a close encounter experience, you won't need me telling you whether that's real or not.
Hi, Paul. Barbara C. here from Canada. With the changes that have been happening all around the world recently, I feel a huge shift in energy, and I feel like collectively humans are regressing. Could all these changes, social, economical, governmental, religious, etc., mean something wicked this way comes?
Thank you, Barb. Yes, we are certainly living in very interesting times. And those who read the Gnostic stories of archontic interference in human government would probably be having a field day right now saying, look, the Gnostics were right. Does something wicked this way come? My perspective is that when I look at the stories of Elohim and Anunnaki and feathered serpents and Aesir and the kings of the Vedas, the report has always been that we've had a multiplicity of company, that we have been curated by a council of others who have, so they believe, a stake in Project Earth, and they don't always agree. So, for instance, in the story of the Enuma Elish, we see that on the Sky Council of that time, there were disagreements about how long human beings should live, how many there should be on the planet, how they could do a cull, how they can manage the birth rate. All these conversations echo in the biblical stories of Elohim and Yahweh as well, and they reflect a tussle. There is a fight going on as to which agenda is going to prevail. And through the Elohim stories of the Bible, there's constant conflicts among the Elohim. And when we look, for instance, at the Yahweh stories over and against the Asherah stories, read them alongside the Dagon stories, the stories of other entities like Milcom and Chemosh, it seems that there is always a tussle over what the right way forward is. And I think our ancestors bequeathed us these stories so that we could not only know how things worked for them, but have a lens through which to understand the present. So I think there's always a plurality of agendas. I mean, just thinking of it at the human level, if you go to the 1% and the influence they exact over public policy around the world, their influence over geopolitics, the 1% is still a community of people who don't all think the same thing. And sometimes they conflict among themselves as to what the best way forward is. And I think today is no different to the past. I think, yes, there are some very dark possibilities on the horizon, but I don't believe our future is set in stone. And I think that just as there are debates at a human level, debates in our parliaments, debates among the corporate types who influence public policy, I think that's how it goes, that there is a tussle, there's a struggle for what's going to happen next. And one of the reasons I write about this in my Eden books is because I think we need to feel like stakeholders in our future, that we shouldn't feel like pawns on Project Earth, and that we should find ways of living that are empowering to ourselves, that we find the choices that we can make to make lives better for ourselves, for our families, for our friends, for our communities. I think the moment we think the future's set in stone is the moment we give up. And our ancestors didn't leave us stories to lead us to that conclusion.
Hello, Paul. Would you be able to share your insights on the Demiurge? Can our souls truly break free from this soul trap and return home to the Pleroma? Thank you.
Hi, Debbie. Well, I personally don't regard this life as a soul trap. And I like the Gnostic vision of the return to the Pleroma, which is echoed in, as I said, in the Gospel of John. The story arc of Jesus is given as a model for ours. And the story arc is one that we pre-exist this life as beings of consciousness, and we survive it as beings of consciousness, hopefully enriched by the experience we've had in this material life. That's the big picture that I find in Plato. That's the picture I find echoed in the New Testament and in many world mythologies around the planet. I find that an enriching way of going about life. If I think I'm here to learn things and have experiences and have as exciting and enriching experience as possible, I find that makes me live more confidently. And that leads to a better human experience. So I don't find soul trap a helpful way of thinking. The Demiurge is a really interesting topic. So some Gnostic writers speak about the Demiurge as being the creator of this universe as we know it, this world as we know it, and as being a rather unpleasant or even evil kind of entity. Plato uses the word differently. Now, it's a Greek word, and it means craftsman. And when Plato uses the word, he's basically saying there's an incredibly powerful kind of being out there that isn't human, but it isn't God either. But it is the class of being who came and terraformed this world to become the world as we know it. And when Plato says that, he really is giving a summary form of what we hear about the arrival of the Anunnaki. What we hear sketchingly of what some of the Elohim were involved with, beings like Asherah in the past who helped us to become a civilization. And so I think that the Demiurgos is understood in various different ways. I like how Plato describes it. It coincides with other story that I find around the world, but it's not an evil being. It's not a being that's come to trap human beings. It's a being that's come to influence the environment, whether terraforming after a catastrophe, like the Younger Dryas, or even adapting the environment so that it could be amenable to what the Vedas described as the kings or the feathered serpents or the dragons of the Elohim stories, so that we've got a planet that's more populated than we generally give it credit for. So there are these different agendas represented by different understandings of Demiurgos, but I don't buy into the idea that there's this powerful being that's using planet Earth to harvest souls and that this is a soul trap. That's not my view.
My question would be, if this were to all be proven to be a simulation, then where does that leave religions?
Thank you, the cosmic realm. That's a really interesting question. I think through my journey in Christianity, I became a Christian when I was 17, and I was in church-based ministry for 33 years. And as I explored Christianity and Christian mysticism, I found in the canonical texts of the Bible and in the Gnostic texts, and then in other mystical texts, as I explored more widely, the idea that there are causalities at play in the universe that are nothing like the simple laws of cause and effect that we might learn in physics and chemistry at school. So in fact, I think some of these religious start points, religious texts, can actually get you somewhere similar to where you'll reach if you think about this world as a holographic universe or as a matrix, to use that language. I think it gets us to a point where we're thinking, what is possible? What other causalities can we reach for to improve our experience as human beings? And when I go to something like Catharism, for instance, or in the modern day to charismatic Christianity, I find there is this continual questing for how can we influence our environment using modalities that we weren't taught at school. I mean, this really is just a modern way of talking about alchemy. How do we transform our material experience using the laws of the universe that we've not yet discovered? And I think it's that kind of journey that we're invited on by sayings like these. There's a saying in the Gospel of Thomas, and it's there in the Gospel of Luke as well: the kingdom of heaven is within you. And if we go to the root meanings of those words, it means the kingdom is the realm of the heavens, but that's sky, that's space, that's the cosmos. So the whole realm of the cosmos is within you, waiting to be taken hold of. This was Jesus's first sermon that he tours with, according to the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew chapter 4. And a saying like that is really an exploration, an invitation to explore. Okay, so if the principles of the cosmos are something I can play with, what does that make possible as I discover more and more what those principles are? And you can get there via mysticism. You can get there via quantum physics. You can get there thinking about the world as a matrix or a hologram. You can get there through Catharism, through charismatic Christianity. But ultimately, I think any human being with curiosity is asking that kind of question. How might things be different? And how might we be able to make things different?
Hello, Paul. My question is about the Watcher, Grigori Angel, that had children with Earth women. Are they still here, and are we their ancestry? Sorry for my English.
Thank you, Carmen. Well, we hinted at this earlier, that hybridization stories are ancient and they're international. And certainly if you go to the Philippines and listen to the stories of the Encantos, or if you go to Wales and hear the story of Tylwyth Teg, or if you go to Ghana and hear the stories of Mamiwata, you will hear stories that bring that experience right into the present, that say we've never been alone, that abduction by non-human, intelligent non-human others has always been part of the human experience, and that the reason behind it is there's some covert hybridization experiment going on. And so that's where I see the Igigi story fitting. It's not a one-off story. It's not a story that only belongs in ancient Sumer, or that only belongs in Genesis 6 or the Book of Enoch, where the Watchers are spoken of. It is an international story. You can go to any continent and you will find stories of abduction for hybridization. Whether you're listening to Aboriginal Australian story or Native American story, you'll find it there too. So I think it's always been part of the human experience. which is why there's always a version of it in the folklore of every culture.
Hello, Paul. The very means of our breath going in and exhaling makes the very sound of the name of God, i.e. Yahweh. Is there any truth in this? Thank you.
Well, that really is a fascinating question, because Yahweh as a word sort of arrives in the Hebrew lexicon from nowhere. And so many scholars believe that it is a loan word from another culture. Maybe it's a Canaanite word that's been imported into the Hebrew lexicon. I have come to believe, and I argue for this in my books, Echoes of Eden and the Eden Conspiracy, that Yahweh isn't a word, it's a sequence of sounds, that the Tetragrammaton is a sequence of sounds. And in that sequence, you've got the two H's, which in Proto-Northwest Semitic, the ancestor of modern Hebrew, were voiced like this. And if I make that sound, yes, it sounds like a breath sound, doesn't it? And I wonder if it is the recollection of what some of these Elohim sounded like. One of the reasons I think that is that the sound recurs in stories all around the world, particularly in the dragon stories that you can find in cultures all around the world. So if you go to Georgia, you'll hear about the Cholchis. If you go to Egypt, you'll hear about Achech. You've got the Coca in Portugal and Spain. You've got the Akuchu in Japan, and this or ch-ch sound keeps recurring. You've got Quetzalcoatl, Kuklumats, Kukulkan. And so this is a sound that repeats in all these different names. It's one of the things that makes me believe it is a sequence of sounds that we're listening to. And I know that there are Hebrew scholars who take the same view that I do. So this is not a debunking or deconstructing kind of argument. You can find Hebrew scholars making exactly the same suggestion. That's a sequence of sounds, which when you say it, does sound like the sound of a raspy breath. And when I was a boy, I used to watch Doctor Who. And you always knew that that monster was in that dark corridor just round the corner because you could hear the of its breath. And I wonder if it's that kind of storytelling in which this sequence of sounds belongs in these ancient stories too.
I would like to ask about the progression towards enlightenment as a society. Consider the worship gene implanted within us and the skin color change and different languages to keep us separated and from collaborating with one another. This type of ancient psyops has been raging since the beginning of humanity, and it needs to stop. How do we counter this worship gene, look within to empower ourselves, keep asking questions, and continue stepping outside of our comfort zones to seek enlightenment? Each individual is so complex, and I'm unsure whether a step-by-step process towards solving this problem is best. Or would the steps change for each individual? To discuss this with a professional is something that is extremely important to me. Please help me on this endeavor. Together, we can change the world.
Kelby, what an amazing question. And I quite agree, together we can change the world. I actually think that is one of the hidden messages of the Bible. In the Eden Conspiracy, I show how translating Elohim stories as God's stories airbrushes out that message that together we can change the world. But you'll have to read the book to get to that point. The worship gene is fascinating. Some people have questioned whether the worship gene is something that predisposes us to being manipulated. Because certainly when you read ancient story, there is the hint that we were developed as a species to being amenable, to being governed. Looking around the world, thinking about the countries in which I've lived, that rings true to me. I think we are very amenable to being managed and being manipulated, but it's actually something entirely separate to the worship gene. The worship gene is something that has been discovered in recent years that plays a role in our experiencing religious or spiritual phenomena. So it's a gene that has to do with the state a person is in when they're meditating, for instance, or when they're having what they would describe as a religious experience. But it's not an experience of manipulation. It's not an experience of servitude. It's an experience of connection and an experience of wonder. It's the kind of experience that would be described by the word oneness or samadhi, where you feel this deep, profound connection with everything, everyone, with the cosmos. And I don't think that's something to be afraid of at all. I think that's something very, very positive. But it's not the same as what the ancients talked about when they talked about wiring human beings so that they could be hoiked and herded. So I don't think the worship gene is something we need to be afraid of. I do agree with the Gnostic view of archontic manipulation that says that we can be manipulated by fear, we can be manipulated into rage, and that sometimes we are governed that way. That if those who govern us can make us angry with the right people or frightened of the right people, then they'll get the results they want. That's the story of the archons in the Gnostic scriptures. And I think there is a really important lesson there, that we need to be very intentional about the mental and emotional state in which we allow ourselves to live. I'm very rationing of my intake of mass media and social media, because I'm very aware that I can have buttons pressed by media pushing a particular view of things or showing me particular images. And I think it's important, just as Plato was teaching, that we're very conscious about living as curious, compassionate, loving, adventurous people, and not being pushed into a funk of depression or hopelessness or fury by external stimuli. So I think the idea of governing by division, making us frightened of one another, making us angry with one another, is something we need to be really, really careful of. The Gnostics talked about archons doing this. Well, algorithms can do it as well. I know back in the 1950s, American intelligence was experimenting with broadcasting frequencies over people to see how that affected their mental state. And again, I think that's something we need to be careful of. What is in our environment? What is affecting our state of mind, our emotional state? And how do I choose the emotional state in which I'm going to conduct myself today or live my life? So yes, I think that intentionality is important. And how do we empower ourselves? I think you answered your own question actually in the last section. I think curiosity is probably the key trait that we have as human beings to make things better. How can things be different to the way they are? How can things be better? And I think we should encourage one another to be curious. I have a lot of people asking me, how can I persuade people that I'm right about paleo contact? And if someone's not curious, then I don't think you can persuade someone. What you can do is find out what your friends and family are curious about and encourage that, strengthen that curiosity muscle, and let's exercise it together. Let us consider together, might things be different to the way we've been told? Can we do things differently to the way we've done it in the past? Yes, I think together we can make a better world, but we need to be able to do curiosity together if we're going to find new ways and make progress. I think curiosity is a big part of what sets us apart from other life on planet Earth. I think curiosity, along with the kind of eyes we have, the kind of hands we have turned us into a technological species and led to all kinds of progress till now. and on into the future.
Hello, Paul. Have you ever had an experience or heard of anyone else experiencing an orb? Do you know what these things are?
Hi, Michelle. Well, orbs are rather topical because people have been reporting seeing orbs in the skies over Great Britain, Germany, America, and wondering what they are. Are they some kind of a craft? Are they some kind of a portal? Other people write to me and say they've experienced orbs in their homes or in places they've been. So rather smaller orbs, balls of light that are moving around and seemingly interacting with spaces or observing people. I don't know what they are, but my theory is that what we see as an orb might be how we see something in this dimension that has come to us interdimensionally. I think if we're being probed or viewed interdimensionally, what we might perceive is an orb. There are experiences that I studied that suggest an orb might be a manifestation of a being. So the being doesn't look like that, but the way we see it in this dimension looks like an orb. And people have said this because of interactions they've had with these phenomena. But it's not an experience I've had myself in terms of interaction. I have seen small orbs. I've seen them in film. I've seen them in rooms that I've been in, but not in a way there was any interaction to give me any kind of clue as to what I was looking at. So I don't really have a developed answer to that, but ask me again in about 12 months and I might have a bit more to say.
Hello, Paul. Greetings from Walla Walla, Washington. I was curious about your take on the woke movement. Do you think those types of things are harming our youth?
Hi, Aviation Madness. I find the word woke a really unhelpful word because it seems to hold together a whole number of social phenomena. And I think it's probably more useful to talk about individual social issues and individual social phenomena and decide together what we think about them. I think the moment we sloganize them and package them together into something called wokeism or anti-wokeism, then we're actually moving away from being able to have an intelligent conversation about things. So it is a word I completely avoid. I'm very happy to discuss individual questions, individual issues, but I think the use of the word woke just distorts our ability to be able to do that. So if you want to come back with a more specific question, I'm very happy to tackle individual issues.
Thank you for your continued work of unveiling the truth over the years. Have you come across any pre-Christian meanings for the starogram symbol? Also, have you encountered any entities or individuals who have tried to silence you over the years for continuously speaking the truth? And if so, how do you protect yourself?
Thanks, Rui. Well, this is exactly why you need to read the Eden Enigma, because I use the word enigma in the title because it's all about decoding ancient symbols. And there are versions of the cross, like the starogram, which long predate Christianity. And many of the meanings that we associate with the Christian cross were already associated with the cross thousands of years before Christianity was thought of. And so the cross can be a symbol that references the sun. It can reference the movement of the sun across the sky. It can reference a star, but it can also refer to a being from the heavens. It can also reference someone who is taxing you, that you're in perpetual debt to them. It can also reference someone who's in charge of you. It can also be used as a symbol that puts a divine imprimatur on violence. And all those associations remained attached to the cross when it got brought into Christianity. And it got brought into Christianity not in the obvious way. It's not all a story of the cross of Jesus and the crucifixion story. When Christianity began, the cross was not central as a symbol within the religion. The fish was, and it was through Constantine bringing his cross, his sun cross, into the symbology of Christianity that it became central, and it came with all the associations I've just mentioned. So the starogram is very similar to the Chi Rho, and it's part of a story in which the cross is used to legitimize empire, and to legitimize violence by the state. If you want to drill further into that, I might just leave my answer at that to whet your appetite, because that's exactly where I go in the Eden Enigma, asking where did these symbols come from? What did they mean before they mean what they mean to us today? What cultures journeyed with these symbols, and how did they originate? So all that is in the Eden Enigma, and I would love to talk to you further about that. I'll do it in future videos. And if you get hold of my book and want to get into a dialogue, then come to the website and we can have a longer conversation there.
Hey, Paul, I am very grateful for your work on YouTube. I would love to hear your opinion on whether there is a biblical connection to Atlantis.
Thank you for that question. It's a good question because, as I say, the original writers of the Gospels and New Testament were very well versed in Plato. I think 12 of the Apostle Paul's most famous sayings are actually Plato quotes, where he's just changed a word or two to give it a spin. So they knew Plato like the back of their hands, and therefore they knew the Atlantis stories, but we don't seem to get any reference to Atlantis or previous civilizations in the New Testament. Where we find references to previous civilizations is in the Hebrew scriptures. And I argue in my Eden series that by the time you get to Genesis chapter 12, we've already had mention of five planetary resets, and by inference, five previous civilizations. The name Atlantis isn't used, and details associated with Atlantis aren't mentioned, but just the broader concept that we are not the first civilization on this planet, and that civilization on this planet may predate Homo sapiens by a very, very long chalk. I think if you go to the text of Genesis and read them with a fresh eye, and I walk the reader through this in my books, you will see this cycle of planetary cataclysms and resets. And of course, you will think, hang on, this sounds like Atlantis. This sounds like the experience of Atlantis disappearing overnight because of some cataclysm that must have been at a planetary level. So there are thematic connections, but as to the details of Atlantis, details of their industry, details of their geopolitical relationships, no, you can't make an equation. You can just say the themes are there.
Is there a connection between the Anunnaki and the Greys?
Chris, that is a really intriguing question. And in my new book, The Eden Enigma, I address directly the question of how do our contact experiences in the present relate to contact experiences in the past? Now, the Greys, in case anyone's not too sure, refers to types of close encounter experiences, types of entity that people report having encountered. And there are two groups. There are the small greys, which are about the size of a 10 or 11-year-old, and they seem to be rather simple kind of beings who would appear to be like the worker drones of another presence. And they're not highly sophisticated. Sometimes they can be resisted. And then there are the tall greys who seem to be more intelligent and perhaps more complex beings. So there is a fair amount of contemporary lore around these kinds of beings, how people experience them, how people encounter them. In the Anunnaki stories, I don't find anything that really is a very close correspondence to that. There are aspects of experiences that repeat. I've mentioned before hybridization narratives. They are ancient and modern. But where I do find stories that sound like our modern conception of a small grey in particular would be if we go to ancient Celtic lore, if we go to the stories of the Shi that we would find described in The Secret Commonwealth, for instance, by Robert Kirk, or if we listen to the Fae stories from Scotland and Ireland, then we hear about these strange beings about the size of a 10 or 11-year-old who people are encountering, who are involved in abduction, who are involved in hybridization. I think once we are able to park our cultural assumptions, when we hear the language of elves and fauns and fairies, immediately we're thinking we're in the land of fiction and fable. If we're going to read the stories for what they actually tell us, the action that's described, then I think the action and the description would suggest to the modern ear this could be small greys that we're looking at. But it's there that I find an equivalence, and I don't really find an equivalence in the Anunnaki stories.
Hi, Paul. Here is my question for you, which is quite simple. What will be the topic of your next book? And, if it is still unknown, what topics would you like to cover on your journey in the future? Thank you, and all the best.
Hi, Sam John Doe. I always enjoy your comments. Thank you for your question. I can answer it very simply because right here is my next book, The Eden Enigma, which is due out at 8 p.m. on, that's American Eastern Standard Time, on March the 15th. It's called The Eden Enigma, and the tagline is, "Do ancient carvings in the mountains of Turkey carry memories of ET contact from the dawn of civilization?" And that is what the book is about. It's about a trip that I made to Turkey with Matt LaCroix, scouting for his new movie. And in the carvings and the cuneiform inscriptions to be found in Turkey is a story that I find echoes all around the world. And it points to this really critical period in the human story following the most recent ice age, when humanity had to reestablish as a dominant presence on planet Earth. And I show that in the stories from ancient Armenia are memories of help that were given in that time. And the kind of help is very detailed and very specific. And it has to do with the rebooting of the ecosystem. So that's what I'm exploring. I'm exploring those lands, all the stories associated with those lands, whether told by the locals or reported by Greek writers, Roman writers, biblical writers, Sumerian writers. There are all these vectors, even Viking or post-Viking writers, all these vectors pointing to what today is Turkey and Armenia, saying these things happened here. The reboot of humanity happened here. Agriculture was invented here. Megalithic building started here. And I just, it's different to the previous books in the Eden series because I'm focused mainly in this one area. And we circle around Turkey and Armenia, finding these evidences of what it was that happened in that period after the Younger Dryas, who it was that helped us, and how it was that they helped us in that critical period.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. Remember to subscribe and click on the bell for notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content. For uncensored access to our full interviews and documentaries, go to fifthkind.tv. For more videos about Paleo Contact and the wisdom of the world's ancestral narratives, go to the Paul Wallace channel, subscribe, and click on the bell. Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV.